Hello, welcome. I'm John Burns, and this is Outside In. I should say that I'm interviewing my guest today, but I think I've angered the gods because there's a tremendous thunderstorm going out around here. So if you hear the odd boom, that's what it is. My guest today is a lifelong naturalist, a broadcaster, and an author. He's had a distinguished career at the BBC National History Unit, and his credits include the BAFTA award-winning Springwatch, Birds Britannia, and The Nature of Britain. And he's written a number of books, including The Robin and Wild Hares and Hummingbirds. And he's a senior lecturer in nature and travel writing at Bath Spa University. Okay, and so Stephen Moss, hi. Thanks for coming on to the show.
A pleasure, John.
Great. I was interested to ask you, how did you first get into natural history? Where did your interest in nature come from?
Well, as David Attenborough once said, when he was asked that by a journalist, he said to him, "Where did you lose yours?" Because his theory, and I think he's right, was all children have this innate love of nature, don't they?
It's
wired in our DNA. And then some people sadly lose it, some more than others. But for me, it's actually my late mother used to tell me the story, which I now repeat so many times. I think I remember it, but I actually don't. Was that at the age of about 3 years old, she took me down to the River Thames in West London, where we lived, the suburbs of London, and got me to feed the ducks. And I fed them, and I saw some funny black ones. And I said, "What are those funny black ducks, Mummy?" And she said, "I've no idea, love, but we've got a book at home." And it was the Observer's Book of Birds, which dates
all right.
round book. And every bird in it, almost every bird in it, was in black and white, which is lucky because, of course, they were coots. Started from there, and I never looked back. And I was passionate about birds all the way through, but it was actually only till I met and started working with Bill Oddie in my late 30s did I realize that there was this whole other world of things out there that Bill knew about, and I was a bit embarrassed I didn't, like butterflies and moths and dragonflies. So I've sort of moved into those as well, but not plants. I'm still terrible on plants.
Yeah, I am constantly embarrassed by my ignorance, you know. Some people seem to be able to have a sort of encyclopedic knowledge of what plants are and can name them in their Latin names without any problem. And I have no idea. You can tell me the Latin name, it's gone in seconds, you know.
too many options on there.
I think there are, yeah. Now, your book that you brought out in March, The Accidental Countryside, what inspired you to write that?
Well, it actually went back, the book itself, the subtitle, I think, does sort of tell you what it's about. It's called Hidden Havens for Britain's Wildlife. And the idea behind it is quite simple. It is places that were created purely for human use that has either taken over or stayed and found a refuge in. And I start with the Peregrines in London, so you always start with now in a book, but I then go back to Moosa Brock on Shetland, the Iron Age, what Bill used to call the Iron Age cooling tower, where the storm petrels nest. I go through churchyards, railway sidings, roadside verges, golf courses, military sites, quarries, gravel pits, peat diggings, you name it. But the key thing is that they were not designed for wildlife. They are now, a lot of them, because a lot of them are now nature reserves. So really, it was a book about that. And the inspiration came from about, 12, 13 years ago. I was making a series with Alan Titchmarsh when I worked in television. And we did a series called The Nature of Britain. And the last programme, I said, I want to do these sort of edgeland habitats, what Richard made me call the unofficial countryside, and we did a whole program on it, including filming at Moosa Brock, and I just became fascinated by these places. Where I started, apart from that river when I was three, after that I used to go down the local gravel pits, and of course, again, I sort of knew their history, but the fact that they become wonderful for wildlife was a fluke. Of course, that wasn't intended at all when they dug them in the post-war era. That's how it all started, really.
I mean, I was interested in your book. I think you talked about as a young boy going to gravel pits, and I guess doing what all young boys do, playing around with sticks and bits of nets and all sorts of things you do. And my own experience parallels that a little bit in that I come from Merseyside originally, And my introduction, I guess, to nature certainly, and it had a profound effect on me. And I was only looking back on it. There were pits, very like there weren't gravel pits, but there were actually clay pits.
Yeah.
That I think were dug. I was on the Wirral, and I think they were dug to build the bricks to make the bricks to build the houses for shipyard workers and dockers, where as that those sort of back-to-back houses were being built. And it always struck me that that nature's a great opportunist, and if you leave a little chink in a door or a way in, nature will find it. Is that what you've found?
Yeah, and as a kid it was Great Christie Greaves, which I didn't appreciate when I was a kid. There were still only a few thousand pairs of them. They'd come back almost from the brink of extinction, you know, 50, 60 years earlier because of the Victorians collecting them. You know, back in the early 20th century, they were extremely rare. Little ring plovers, of course, nested in what Kenneth Allsop called that messy limbo that is neither town nor country. Basically, the suburb I grew up in was where the ring plovers nested, you know, the second time they nested. And so, yeah, for me, these places are very special. And I dedicate the book to a number of people, including Kenneth Allsop, who's a great hero of mine, but also Richard Mabey, of course, who wrote The Unofficial Countryside, and Chris Baines, who's a dear friend of mine. And Chris, in his lovely book, The Wild Side of Town, which I quote extensively in my book, talks about, he thanks robber barons, old and new. He said, basically, you know, in the north of England in particular, it was those men in the Victorian era who built things and quarried stuff and created these sort of places that then became these accidental habitats, you know. So, and it's carried on, you know, the peat diggings in Somerset are now one of the best nature reserves in Britain, really, you know, with three different kinds of egrets nesting there. Again, they would have been just fields, pasture fields. They're not now. They were dug out. The peat was removed. That wasn't a particularly good thing. But the benefit, the silver lining, was these wonderful habitats.
Yeah, and I was interested, you know, we're talking about animals or wildlife finding a way in what you were saying about peregrine falcons actually sort of finding a home in London. Yeah. I was interested in that. Why do you think, I'm trying to ask you, why did that take so much time? How did that happen, do you think?
Well, it took so much time because in the 60s, 50s and 60s, because of DDT, that it didn't kill them. It went up the food chain and thinned their eggs.
I see.
And also they were persecuted and some pairs were stolen for falconry and things. But, you know, I didn't see a peregrine. I've been birdwatching since I was a toddler. I did not see a peregrine until I was in my mid-20s. And then I started seeing a few more, and now I don't see them that regularly, but, you know, as you know, they're a relatively widespread bird. They're in virtually every big British city now. They nest, you know, in Bath and Swansea and Cardiff and Glasgow and Chichester and Norwich, you know, Derby. And they've done that. I mean, I use the phrase analog habitat, which I wish I'd coined. But an analog habitat is basically the man-made equivalent of a natural habitat. Now, when I was young, I used to think peregrines were rare. This is what the way you think, isn't it? When something's rare.
Peregrines are
rare because they must be very specialised. They must need a certain kind of place to live. And, you know, they're very specialised feeders. Well, they are in the sense they only feed on birds, but there's a lot of birds out there. And so peregrines, of course, are not specialists at all. They are. You know, they've been allowed to come back. They're not persecuted. They're not poisoned, by and large, now. And so they've moved into cities because, to them, the top of the Tate Modern is exactly the same as a sea cliff or a high crag. You know, it's a place they can nest. And there's a lot more birds in London than there are in an awful lot of upland places. You know, they were only in uplands in the 60s and 70s when I was growing up. They were only in uplands because everywhere else they were killed,
persecuted. Have the peregrines had to adapt their behavior in any way, or they've just sort of slotted into to being to London life?
I think they've slotted in. When I met David Morrison, who's the sort of Mr. Peregrine in London, really helpful guy, right. Showed me the peregrines on the Houses of Parliament, which, of course, yeah, peregrine is a grey bird that spends most of the day sitting around. It's very easy to miss them.
Right.
They look like a pigeon sitting there. It was only when he pointed out, oh, yeah, I could see that. You know, if I'd scanned for an hour, I would have found it, of course. But, you know, he knew where they sit. And he said to me, one of the interesting things, because I said, where do they go in winter? Do they go off to the Thames estuary? Because I used to see them there. And he said, no, they don't need to. You know, there's pigeons and parakeets all over London, lots of small birds, and they hunt up and down the Thames, and all the prime territories are on the Thames. I think there's something like 25 pairs of peregrines in London now, which is probably more or less saturation point. And he said, what they're doing is, you know, they can hunt all year round there. They don't need it. If you live on a mountaintop, all the birds leave, all the skylarks and meadowparrots leave in winter.
Yeah, so you have to
But they don't need to do that, you know. So they've adapted in that sense. But, you know, as I've always said, urban areas, yeah, the urban jungle is called that, not because it's bad for wildlife, because it's brilliant for wildlife.
Yeah, I mean, what also surprises me, one of the things that you said in your book is that people rarely look up.
Yeah,
I know that's true.
It's my friend, the urban birder, he always says, just look up. And the things he's seen flying over London. And of course, in lockdown, I've been in my garden in Somerset. I have seen 8, I think, species of raptor this year. I haven't seen kestrel yet over the garden. But I've seen hobby and red kite and marsh harrier and peregrine and sparrowhawk, you know, because they're, you know, partly because I've been looking up more, because, you know, if you look up, you will, you know, you might have to look up for a while, but you will see these things.
Well, yes, that's interesting because my flat, I live right by the River Ness, and right at the moment in lockdown in June of 2020, I'm not allowed to go more than 5 miles from where I live.
Oh, that's right, yes.
So, and what I've been doing is every morning walking along the riverside, and I've seen a lot more bird life than I actually expected. And it also interested me. And so what effect do you think lockdown has? Do you think we're just seeing more, that they were always there and we see them? Or do you think there has actually been some sort of change in the environment as a result of perhaps less pollution because of lockdown?
Yeah, I think possibly. I think the key thing that has changed definitely is friends of mine who live on rivers, and this is one in the centre of London in Limehouse and another on the Thames for much in the, you know, the more rural parts of the Thames.
Yes.
They're seeing, and Steve Batchel was talking about this the other day, he lives in Henley, yeah, the TV presenter, because there's loads of things like great Christogreaves, moorhens and coots, which are there, but they always hide away. And he said they're not. They're coming right in the middle. My friend in London seen all sorts of things going up and down, including, what did he see the other day? Was it a porpoise? He saw
a porpoise.
Great seal. That's right. Grey seal swimming up the Thames. Now, it's not that they don't do it. It's just there's a lot of river traffic on the Thames, a lot of boats going up and down. And so I think things like great Christogreaves will have had a good year. I think what was interesting is a lot of the friends of mine who are not naturalists said to me, do the birds always sing like this at this time of year? And I said, yeah, they do. But there was an interesting point on the radio, on that More or Less programme, where they were saying, are they singing louder? And they found a scientist who said, actually, they're not. The opposite's happening. It's so quiet that the birds are able to sing at a lower level, but they're being heard much better.
Yes.
So the paradox is they're actually singing as much as they always did, but they're singing at a lower level, but we're hearing them much better than we were.
Yeah, yeah. I did wonder whether, well, as you know, the sort of the heart of the bird food chain certainly is you know, insect life drives a lot of bird life, and certainly I noticed hunting across the river just outside my window, really, far more swifts and house martins than I've seen for a long time.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think with the air pollution being less, and also we've had a very warm spring, haven't we, and sunny spring. The butterflies in my garden, I mean, I can, you know, you can go time in summer where you don't see a butterfly for hours on end, sometimes even here in Somerset. This spring, summer, you know, everywhere I look, there's butterflies, and it's been brilliant. And I think that's the third year in a row. But that's partly to do with the weather. It's partly, you know, and And of course, we're at home more. We're seeing stuff, as you say.
Yeah. What do you think is the sort of, do you think the future's changing, or the way we treat our wildlife? Because in some ways, certainly things are changing, I think, in the Highlands, and the way we relate to our wild places. And I wondered if, do you think that's happening in England? And has lockdown influenced that at all?
I think what it has done, I was talking to Chris Packham a while ago, and he said that he realised, and the surveys proved this, that lots more people feel engaged with nature than they did. They've done their walks in yes. cities and towns in particular, where they're only allowed to, and they've started seeing nature. They've noticed things like house martins and swifts. They've sometimes inquired as to what they are. You know, maybe they used to watch them when they were kids. An awful lot of people used to be into wildlife and then sort of lose it, you know. Yeah. So I think what's happened is that he said we've got to keep them now. You know, we've hooked them. Now we've got to keep them. And that's partly my hope. I think there are hopes about, you know, the understanding about sustainability. You never know, do you? I mean, I'm not a great fan of today's politicians, with some notable exceptions. I just hope that they realise that actually you can have both. You can have wildlife, you can have good food, good quality food, you can pay farmers more, which is a big issue, of course, in England in particular. Yeah. Scotland, you know, people say, well, why are there so many cuckoos and spotted flycatchers in the Highlands? Well, it's because you don't mess about with the land. The farmland is not messed about in a way that it is, say, in Eastern England in particular. And I know parts of Scotland are not perfect at all, but certainly sure. I go, you know, sort of like the Black Isle, I'm really impressed by the amount of birds I'm seeing.
Yeah.
Where I live in Somerset, it's not bad. It's less intensive farming. It's mostly silage and pasture, and it's not, you know, it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than wall-to-wall arable. So I hope things will change. I mean, the sad thing about writing the book The Accidental Countryside, I found, and I only realized this, as you often do when you finish a book, I sort of realized what it's really about. What it's really about, and I did have an inkling of this, is why do I have to write this book? Supposing we had decent countryside for wildlife all over Britain, yeah. and we could easily do this and still produce food and still have housing and, you know, all the things.
Sure.
Did it properly, my book would become completely irrelevant. And there's nothing I'd like better than in 20 years time someone to say, oh, Stephen wrote that book, what a funny book to write, because it doesn't really make sense because all these things are everywhere now,
you know. Yes, in many ways you're talking, well, it's interesting some of the things that you're saying, because I think that you're talking about the survivors.
Yeah.
From, you know, as you so rightly said, you know, there are some animals that have adapted to live in the sort of the cracks between our industrial societies, I suppose. But an awful lot haven't. So really, you are writing about those that are sort of clinging on. And I think you one of the things that you said, I think sort of keyed in on one of the things that I think is that, you know, even in the Highlands, wild as it appears, there's no real wilderness here left. It's all carries the hand of man in it. But there is here and there in the little corners that you can seek out, you can catch a glimpse of what I call wildness. I don't know if that meshes with what you feel.
Places, isn't it? I mean, you go to Dorset, and the Dorset County Council, who are doing a brilliant job saving taxpayers almost $100,000 a year by not mowing the verges. So those verges now have orchids, they have, you know, marbled white and brown Argus butterflies and things like that. So these are quite specialised, or we think of them as specialised creatures. But what those things shouldn't be on a roadside verge. Well, they should be in hay meadows, but there are, and, you know, wildflower meadows, but there aren't any of those. And, you know, I'd love it if we didn't need to have, you know, roadside verges good for wildlife. It'd be nice if they are anyway, because the other difference is most of the habitats I write about in this book are incredibly accessible. And I'm always a bit sceptical about wilderness. You know, you go to the Cairngorms and people say, what a wild place it is. It's like, really? It's thousands of walkers and skiers and shooters and bird watchers and goodness knows what, you know, which is great. I don't have an issue with that. You know, I think it's good. But a lot of the places I write about in the book, like railway paths between Bristol and Bath, or, you know, churchyards, they're places that are accessible to people. They're accessible also to people who either because they live in cities or because they're from different socioeconomic groups or perhaps because they're from a visible ethnic minority, they don't feel comfortable or have access to what we call the countryside.
Yeah.
And the great thing is, of course, they don't need to have access to the countryside because it's in the cities. And a lot of these places I wrote about are very diverse in terms of the people who go there. The classic one is Woodbury Woodlands in Hackney. It's an old reservoir. It was absolutely hopeless for birds when it was a reservoir because it was full of chemicals. And they've London Wildlife Trust have transformed it into this wonderful recreational and nature reserve. It's free to get into. It's got a little cafe. And you go there and, you know, it seems like half of Hackney's gone there, which is brilliant. You know, people are going there who would never have access to the wider countryside. They don't have motor transport. They wouldn't know where to go necessarily. And they don't. They're not going there to see nature. They're going there just to have a nice sit or a walk. But of course, they're then seeing nature and their kids are seeing nature. And that's for me, that's possibly the most important thing about these places.
Yeah, I suppose part of it, I don't know, is learning how to look, because if you know, once you start to look, and I think it goes back to that childhood thing you were talking about, because I think children have insatiable curiosity, and sadly I think we kind of lose that curiosity. But if you learn how to look, it is incredible what you will see.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the places I went are astonishing. Well, I mean, one of my favourite places is Canvey Wick, which is an old brownfield nature reserve. It's the first brownfield nature reserve, but it's an old brownfield site. It was in the old oil crisis of the early 70s, which I remember. They were going to build an oil refinery there, and they made these big concrete slabs, and they never put the actual tanks up, and they mothballed it, and they never did anything. And it sat there, because Canvey Island is a really, really poor economically place. You know, no one ever wanted to develop it. Then they looked to develop it and someone went, do you know what? It's got quite a lot of wildlife on it. Well, it turns out it's the second best place for invertebrates in Britain.
Really? That's amazing.
Variety of things. It's got lizards, it's got snakes, it's got loads of fantastic invertebrates and wildflowers. It's got a reasonable number of good birds. But it's really, bug life helped convert it into a nature reserve. It was called England's rainforest. And Patrick Barkham, the writer on The Guardian, said actually it's England's savannah, which is a much better description because it's sort of dry and scrubby and a bit of grassland and stuff. Yeah. But it's absolutely fantastic for wildlife. Yeah, butterflies, dragonflies, everything. And it's a place that would have been built on, would have been destroyed without local people actually saying, I think this place is good. And there are so many places like that that have been saved, which I write about in the book. It's a fairly positive book in that, you know, I'd love the rest of the countryside to be as good for wildlife as these places are, but these places are still needed for the very fact that they are good for people. That's an absolutely key message from the book.
Yeah. I think it's one of the important things I think that when we look at nature is that the key thing I think probably it really is the attitude of people. It's a relationship. Nature has to be, well, I'm trying to say, I suppose, is if people value nature and understand it, then its future will be much brighter in the British Isles. Is that something you think?
Absolutely. I think we've always regarded, not always, a lot of people regard nature, particularly policymakers, politicians, civil servants, people in business, regard nature as a sort of bolt-on extra. They'd quite like to have it.
Yes.
That has changed dramatically. I went to a conference about 10 years ago now. Tony Juniper was there, chairing it, from used to be Friends of the Earth, now Natural England. And Tony was saying that some of the firms that were there, Marks and Spencers, Cemex, the people who do quarries, he said they're not greenwashing. They are doing fantastic work for nature because actually it helps their bottom line, but also it's really good for their employees. So they were saying that the people, you know, Cemex had dug these quarries out and then turned them back for nature, because what else you can do? You can't fill them in again once you've taken all the soil. They fill with water, so why not make it good for nature? And then they'd encourage their employees to come along and actually volunteer at weekends and take kids there, and they said it had this hugely positive effect on their workforce. So this is what I mean, these things are win-win situations. If we value nature, it will help us. And I think people have got that from the crisis. What worries me is we will suddenly, we saw on the beaches yesterday, we'll suddenly all go back to normal. And no matter how many times our Prime Minister talks about good old British common sense, most people, a large number of people in Britain do not have any common sense when it comes to things like going to the beach and leaving litter everywhere and setting fires on heaths in the dry spring air. And having raves on nature reserves in Leeds and these things. Why is the politicians and they need to step up, because business, I firmly believe that business, which now takes a much longer view, gets it. I think most businesses realise that if they can become more sustainable, it helps them. And this is a big environmental thing. It can do with their heating costs, their recycling, all those things, but also the message they're giving out, the way they, try to help nature. And I think a lot are getting that. Not all of them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But if they do get it, I went to the Rolls-Royce factory 15 years ago in Goodwood. You don't see the Rolls-Royce factory until you're almost on top of it. Do you know why? It's in the middle of a huge quarry, and it has a massive green roof absolutely covered in nesting skylarks.
All right. OK, that's amazing.
That was all planned by the company. And yes, it enables them to say, look what we're doing. And, but I don't believe their motives are entirely cynical. I do think that business gets it. I think who don't get it are politicians. I think they absolutely, and this is almost all parties, they're always looking for the short-term gain, and nature isn't really a short-term gain. I think they're enthralled to a lot of people who claim to have the, to be custodians of the countryside.
Sure, yes.
I'm talking about big landowners, organizations like the Countryside Alliance, which lobbies and has enormous, hugely negative effects on our wildlife, with 80,000 members, which is pathetic, frankly. And I don't mind, I hope they'll listen to this. They probably won't, of course. But, these people should be ashamed of the way that they have allowed our countryside to be destroyed. I don't blame farmers. Most farmers are really struggling to make a living. They are forced to sell food ludicrously cheaply because supermarkets squeeze them, and we in turn demand cheap food. So it's not their fault. I think a lot of it's our fault and the system's fault. But there are lobby groups, and I'm been really pleased recently that the National Farmers Union, under the new leader, she really seems to get it, and she has been lobbying for much better food standards, for subsidies that are based on doing good for the countryside rather than simply giving the largest landowners the most money. I think she's an absolute force for good, and I hope that happens with other organizations.
And the virus as well has thrown that into relief. I mean, I suppose the jury's still out on where coronavirus came from, but there certainly seems to be a fair amount of evidence that it's basically the way we treat the natural environment. Well, people eating exotic animals that they would never have come into contact with before.
Absolutely. I mean, think about pangolins and bats. I mean, it is insane. And we can be, you sometimes have to be careful about cultural sensitivity, but frankly, this sort of way of doing it. And again, sometimes it's an economic reason. Sometimes it's the poor people who are actually hunting these animals aren't necessarily benefiting from it very much, But yeah, we do have to deal with that. We have to deal with what's happened in China, with other places. Africa, is a bit of a basket case at the moment when it comes to people, killing animals for food. I wrote a piece recently about vultures in Africa, and it's tragic what's happened there. And it's a lot of it is it's things like poachers of rhinoceroses and elephants are killing vultures because, of course, when they kill the rhino to get the tusks, the vultures all gather, and then the rangers can find the poachers.
Right, okay.
It's a sort of knock-on effect. So there are a lot of terrible things happening, but as you say, we've learned something from the virus. It's a warning from nature. I'm not saying I wish it had happened. Of course I'm not. But we have to find a way of changing, and I think it has made everyone stop and think. I just hope that when things get back to what people are calling the new normal, we've learned some lessons from it.
Yes, I think that's right. And so if you had a crystal ball and maybe you took, say, maybe 20, 30 years in the future, what do you, where do you think we'll be there in terms of our relationship with the natural world, how we fire, how we farm, how we use the land? Can you, where would you like to see us? Maybe that might be, has that got a fairer question, perhaps?
I try to be optimistic because I'm naturally an optimist. I suppose I hope, because that will be, towards the end of my life at that point. I turn 60 this year, so it's sort of, which is a bit really. And I hope I will start to see changes. Climate change obviously is the huge worry. There are things that, that are things we can be positive about. The fact that the price of oil's dropped so much, and therefore lots of oil fields are now uneconomic and look like they may be uneconomic forever, and the fact that renewable energies are becoming so much cheaper, much quicker than anyone expected, and we need that to sort of kickstart that movement towards sustainability. And if we can do that, then wildlife will start to benefit. But you read a book like Rebirding by my friend Benedict MacDonald, who's a young, fantastic book, and Ben has come up with a manifesto in that, a very positive manifesto of how in Britain, for example, being more nature friendly in the uplands would totally, transform the amount of tourism and the tiny amount of money that things like grouse moors make for the local people. They make most of it for the rich landowners. That could be multiplied by a huge amount, as has happened in the Cairngorms. And the Cairngorms is a very fine example of wildlife tourism, the whole osprey stuff and everything. There's a lot of businesses up there. So, perhaps the fact we'll probably have to stay at home for the next few years, maybe that will change that. I think we need to look at how we farm the uplands. I think we need to look at how we farm the lowland countryside and find ways, and it will probably involve raising prices of food, but it also raise standards of food. And we do have this opportunity. I'm not a fan of Brexit or COVID-19, but both of them give us an opportunity to recalibrate what we do. If we go down the route of cheaper and cheaper food, and just handing out money to farmers for nothing, which I hope won't happen. Now, if we give money where it's due and we help people who farm in a good way, and there are so many of them out there, I've met them over the years, and often they're doing it at their own expense, which is terrible. They're actually losing money in subsidies by devoting some of their farm because they live in the countryside. They want it to be nice, So I'm hoping we can turn the corner. I think Ben's book is fantastic. I think things like what Isabella Tree and Charlie Burrell have done at NEP is extraordinary. I think a lot of the work that organisations are doing, landowners are doing, particularly in Scotland, the big new landowners who come in and don't, do I think believe that they should have trees in the uplands, for example. Not a very controversial view in the whole of Europe and Asia, but seems to be very controversial in Britain, that particularly Scotland, and the Lake District. So, let's hope that we can do things. And I know so much good work's going on, particularly in the Scottish Islands, from landowners and conservationists. So, fingers crossed.
Well, let's hope that the future is bright. I do think things are changing. I do think things are starting to move in the right direction. And I very much enjoyed your book. So thanks very much, Stephen. And
You're
that's
welcome.
Stephen Moss talking about the accidental countryside. Thanks very much, Stephen. You take care.